Record-breaking temperatures have hit Europe in recent weeks, leading to hundreds of deaths and worsening conditions for wildfires in southern Europe. In the U.S., triple digits are expected this week in the Plain States, with temps that could go as high as 115 degrees. Our next guest says extreme heat can have serious, even deadly effects for those of us living through it. He's with us to explain what's driving the extreme heat we're seeing, how it's connected to climate change, and what we can do about it. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed more heat waves where you live? Does the heat dictate in part what you do and don't do? Have you experienced any heat-related illnesses like heat exhaustion? And if you work outside, what are the hot summer months like for you in your job? Are they getting worse? Call 800-642-1234, and that's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Chris Uejo is an associate professor in the College of Social Sciences and Public Policy at Florida State. He studies how the physical environment affects health and well-being. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Pleasure to be here, Dean.
Well, temperatures in some parts of Europe are starting to cool down a bit today, but it's still really hot in other areas. And I mentioned those triple-digit temperatures expected soon here in the U.S. What do we know about what's driving all this heat right now?
Sure. So extreme heat is a widespread and pernicious problem. While in some respects, some of the same weather patterns may be promoting extreme heat across the United States and parts of Europe, there is an intensification or an amplification of some of those weather patterns that's essentially causing these periods of short and extreme intense heat to become more intense, longer lasting, geographically widespread due to climate change.
And 100-degree day is an occasional thing here in Wisconsin and other parts of the U.S., but Britain and France are less used to that. Can you talk about how significant the temperatures they're seeing are right now?
Sure. One way to think about it is there's a weather station that in the central part of the United Kingdom that has records going back to the 1700s, and this is by far the hottest day that they've seen. So I'm currently based in Florida, so I'm familiar with Wisconsin and did my graduate studies there. So while it may seem not that extreme to a Floridian or someone in the southern United States, to a place that is not adapted to extreme heat, something like a 40 degrees Celsius day is life-threatening and can bring some consequences, not just to human health, but closing down of airports and critical infrastructure and other cascading impacts to society.
And I'd imagine what qualifies as extreme in one area depends partly on, as you said, how well adapted a city or a country is to heat and kind of the safeguards they have in place. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes. So many of us think of things like, particularly here in the United States, we might initially think of access to air conditioning and cooling, but also our bodies normally physiologically adapt over the course of the summer season. So we experience the same heat exposures in, say, the end of August, we'd be more readily available to respond to that versus the beginning of May, for example. There's also adaptations such as federal regulations on safe work-to-rest ratios, how we build and design our cities, and even when it's okay to take breaks due to the extreme heat.
And what does the data tell us about how this extreme heat and the frequency of it is changing over time?
Sure, great point. So we know that pretty much across the world, the frequency of, with high confidence, the frequency of these extreme heat events, or in this case, I may call them heat waves, but these sort of short, multi-day, notably different than previous conditions of higher heat exposures are becoming more common, longer lasting, and geographically widespread, meaning covering a larger area and exposing more people. So essentially, this is just part of our trajectory, unfortunately, towards a different climate future.
We're talking with Chris Uejo right now, an associate professor at Florida State University who studies how physical environments affect health and well-being. We're talking about the heat waves we're seeing right now in Europe, hot temperatures expected across much of the U.S. this next week. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Has the high heat affected your work, what you do in your day-to-day life? Have you ever felt the physical impacts of high heat? Let us know, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chris, we talked a little bit about it, but could you expand a bit on the health impacts and the physical symptoms that can come with high heat?
Sure. We're learning, and so while we understand a fair amount about extreme heat, we're learning more and more every day. And what we're finding out is extreme heat is impacting a much wider range of our health systems and our body's regular functioning than we had previously understood. So some of that is well recognized, such as our cardiovascular system. Essentially, your heart has to work harder to pump more blood to the skin to dissipate heat. Our respiratory system, your lungs, essentially breathing in hotter and humid, more humid air is more work for your lungs. Our kidney system, essentially our renal system and kidneys, their dehydration and a variety of different pathways may be impacted by extreme heat. But we're also encountering some things that we weren't as initially expected, such as mental health complications. We know that those 911 medical 911 calls for those also systematically increase across the nation during high heat periods. So both it's more than just heat exhaustion and heat stroke, but also for those with pre-existing health conditions. And there's quite a variety of those that could be exacerbated by extreme heat exposure.
And who should be most on the lookout for the effects of high heat on their physical well-being?
Great question. So everyone is at risk for extreme heat, but some groups face higher risks. So as you're mentioning, in your place that's not as well adapted like the United Kingdom, everyone faces higher risks. If you are in a place that does have some social or physiological adaptations, there's still some groups that we're most concerned about. And it's a pretty wide, they span a wide gamut of the population. Some of those include older adults who are more likely to have pre-existing health conditions, some of the ones that we had mentioned, and also take medications that might increase their heat sensitivity or dehydration. Pregnant people and newborns, and related to that, sort of young children, as well as all the way up to those who are engaging in youth sports or youth activities outdoors when they may not be acclimated to these high heat exposures. Along those same lines, people who work or exercise outdoors have higher heat exposures and therefore risk. And sort of a key group that we're seeing here in the southern part of the United States is the unhoused, or essentially people who cannot avoid some of these higher heat exposures.
Yeah, could you talk a bit more about the question of I guess, equity across social class here and income and wealth and how that can affect who is most affected when we see some of these heat waves?
Sure. Income is really important, and more so these days when we know that there's an energy crisis and the price of electricity may be increasing for many people. So we know that the impacts of heat on health are inequitable. We know that people who are more likely to work outdoors are also to be more likely to be lower income and to some extent people of color. One way that I sort of framed to think about this was there is this very rich hotel in Dubai that proposed creating the world's first air conditioning beach. Stated another way, that maybe those with the highest economic resources can afford to adapt even for leisure. But those who have limited means to adapt are really bearing the brunt of that, and that's both within the United States and globally.
Sure. I know that I think all of us probably recognize the impact on our electricity bill when we turn the AC on for the for the summer. It costs money. Certainly costs money if that AC goes down. And Chris, I understand that you have some experience with that growing up and the AC being out on what always seems like the hottest day of the year.
Yes, definitely. I lived in Arizona before I had moved to Wisconsin in my graduate studies, and as a graduate student, you know, my rent was $250 a month, and which was less than what I would pay during the summer for energy. But living in an apartment like that, almost every summer, without fail, my cooling system would break down during the hottest part of the summer. And one day I did personally experience extreme heat. I won't say it's not a life or death experience, but it is unsettling. Your heart starts to beat out of control, and nothing you can do can calm it down, whether that's trying to run your arms underwater or put your head in. Until I took the drastic step of putting my head in the freezer to finally start to calm myself down. And I've had enough of these episodes that I can't say there's much good to have come from it. The only good thing of living in a place where you've had not great infrastructure is that the heat was strong enough to kill the bed bug.
We're talking with Chris Owejo right now, professor at Florida State University who studies extreme heat and the public health response to it. He's with us today to talk about the heat wave happening in Europe and more hot temperatures expected in the U.S. this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the risk of heat waves becoming more common with climate change? Does the heat affect the way you work, your job, where you've chosen to live? What questions do you have about trends in extreme heat, and are there ways you'd like to see us better prepare for it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk about extreme heat, what's causing it, the link to climate change, and how it impacts people's health. Chris Owejo with Florida State University stays with us. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. When the temperature rises, do you stay inside? Are you able to stay inside? If not, what impact does it have on your life and your work when it's 90, 100 degrees? And have you ever felt the physical impacts of high heat? Let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Chris, earlier we were talking a little bit about some of the things that cities, states, countries can do to adapt to our current reality of frequent heat waves. What are some of the things you've seen around the U.S., maybe at the city level, that hold some promise in keeping people safe from the heat?
Sure. Wisconsin's a bit of a leader in this area. I've had the pleasure of working with, I used to run a program for the state of Florida, and then I would run across my Wisconsin counterparts, Megan Christensen and Colleen Moran, John Myman. But essentially, they've done a variety of things. First is just trying to figure out who is suffering and when these groups are suffering from extreme heat so that one can start to target those interventions. And then perhaps moving a bit to another example, there's a variety of leaders there. There is no sort of gold standard yet, but there's places like New York City that are doing everything from testing out programs where they have volunteers check in with their neighbors during extreme heat episodes. And they have also, during COVID, when their cooling shelters or refuges were shut down, they had disseminated air conditioning units to those, as well as vouchers for the ability to pay for the air conditioning units to a variety of at-risk households.
Sure. So the actual act of having a network of people to check in on neighbors, check in on people living in a community if there is something like a power outage, say.
Yes. And what's wonderful about that, it's not necessarily a high expenditure sort of endeavor, and it builds community. The city of Philadelphia originally created the program. It was called from its Philly Blocks program, and it was originally actually created to target neighborhood crime. So the same thought being that if we are building in these stronger networks, maybe there's some other potential benefits to building communities. and to increase resilience, not just to heat, but to a variety of other hazards or disasters.
And public cooling centers, is that something that we see holding some promise too for this kind of problem?
Great question. I'd say the jury's still out. It is probably the most common preferred method by municipalities to address extreme heat at the moment. There's been some limited work looking at how effective that really is. Some places are running them really well and effectively, but there are some well-known roadblocks to those. For many of them, you might need to have a car to get to them, which is a large challenge. Some of them are not open during the evening times, and et cetera. At this point, I think the more that I still applaud those municipalities heading down this path as sort of a first step towards taking further action.
And for people who exercise, or especially young people who play sports outside during the hot weather, that can be especially dangerous. Are there standards out there that you would kind of recommend more places implementing when it comes to practices, games outside?
Yes, absolutely. For the past 30 years or so, and even beyond that, we've heard, unfortunately, stories of mostly professional athletes, but also locally, I'm sure, in your communities as well, of perhaps most commonly football players, but certainly other people who play other sports as well, suddenly falling ill from heat-related illness and dying on the field. So the Corey Stringer Institute, among others, is a leader in this field. They come up with a ranking with how well certain jurisdictions are doing for heat-related guidance. But long story short is we have a pretty clear guidebook on how to prevent heat-related illness in our young athletes. Essentially, you have to acclimate them, following similar protocols that we use for outdoor workers. You'd have to have medical staff who are trained and on the scene and know how to respond to heat-related illness. And you'd have to be willing to reschedule some events if they're going to take place during unsafe conditions.
And Chris, something that we hear about maybe when we talk to our neighbors in the southern U.S. is, oh, it's 105 degrees, but it's a dry heat. And here in Wisconsin, I think we all sort of dread the humidity. Is there a difference when it comes to the danger heat poses when it's drier or when it's more humid?
Sure. Great questions. Both have their challenges. So in a place like Wisconsin, where you could potentially get weather systems or air masses with both types, a dry heat from the desert or a more moister heat from my neck of the woods, both can be harmful. All else being equal, at the same number or temperature number, the moister heat is more dangerous because it limits the body's ability to sweat, which is its most effective way to cool down. But that being said, I wouldn't scoff at a high dry heat either. As for example, Arizona is the nation's leader in the number of heat-related deaths still, largely due to its dry heat.
And in general, Chris, at all levels of government, whether that's local, whether that's federal, do you think that there's enough action on this issue right now, especially seeing that we're likely going to be experiencing more heat waves in the future, or do we need a little more urgency around this?
Yes, absolutely need more action here. We need to deploy chief heat resilience officers. I've had the pleasure of working with Jane Gilbert in Miami-Dade County and her team as the world's first chief heat resilience officer. We need to have metrics to track what's happening with extreme heat and how we can manage it, and as well as these creative interventions that have win-win potential with some of the other things that are important to us, whether that's stormwater mitigation or greenhouse gas mitigation, or just providing more green or verdant neighborhoods that are provide physical activity space opportunities. So unfortunately, there isn't a dedicated, even a federal agency that is really in charge of extreme heat. NOAA is sort of stepping up to the plate at the moment, but the funding has not been there. And some of the other climate health funding, unfortunately, did not come through with Build Back Better and its related offshoot. So it still is an all-hands-on-deck moment.
And as we wrap up, Chris, what are you watching for next when it comes to either the weather forecast or how we here are doing it, responding to it?
Sure. Right. I know that a lot of this sounds more like doom and gloom, but I do see glimmers of hope. I see glimmers of hope every time there's a new chief heat officer. Hope whenever there's more interest. I think I haven't seen, to be honest, this much interest in my 17 years working on extreme heat on this topic until this year, and I think that's helpful for it. I'm looking for sort of creative, out of the box ways to also to deal and prevent with extreme heat in an equitable fashion, whether that's energy subsidies, whether that's installing a cooling safe space or resilience hub in a low-income housing high-rise unit. There's a variety of things that, to be honest, I don't think we've fully thought of that are needed. So we need you, we need your listeners, we need everyone to bring their creative energies to some of these wicked problems.
Well, Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Dean.
That was Chris Uwejo. He's an associate professor in the College of Social Sciences and Public Policy at Florida State University. He was with us today to talk about the impact of extreme heat, with record heat in Europe and triple-digit temperatures expected in parts of the U.S. next week. Coming up after the news, working in customer service jobs takes a lot of emotional energy. A UW-Milwaukee professor shares her research on the toll it can take and how to make those tough interactions less likely. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.